Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and happy to be with you again. The past week has been quite eventful, and there's news on several fronts. I'm just going to jump right in and start out with the story that I have gotten the notice of the Southern Poverty Law Center Hate Watch bloggers. In fact, the evil and extremely ugly operator at SPLC, Mark Potok, wrote the blog dated September 21st after reading my book, Auschwitz, The Underground Guided Tour, What the Tour Guides Don't Tell You at Auschwitz-Birkenau. I want to assure you that I'm not making a personal attack on Potok, although it seems like it, by calling him ugly in retaliation for his personal attacks on me, but because he really has one of the most grotesque visages you will ever encounter, someone who will truly frighten children. And I am a believer that in most cases the physical follows the spiritual in the inner, so it's a kind of a giveaway there. When he opens his mouth and speaks, I watched a short part of a video of his. Wow, it's even more frightening because his mouth is like this awful gaping hole. It's just unbelievable, this person. I thought of putting his face on the program page for this show, maybe alongside my own, since I'm so angelic looking. I couldn't resist that. But I don't want to have to look at it again. Once is enough. Now, I started thinking, based on Mark Potok's appearance, that if we ever became a captive people, what torture it would be just to have to look at the horrible, repulsive faces of so many of our enemies standing over us and having control over us. Well, I just have to say this because it's a horrible thought for me. I have thought about it at other times with other people. And I'm not saying it as a form of hate, even though it can be presented as that. But it is so true, and we should think about things like this to give us more courage to resist. Back to the review of my book. The review is titled, Lying About Auschwitz, The Barnes Review on the Nazi Death Camp. I want to mention that I believe Potok learned of my book and of me via my guest appearance on the Mike Piper Show on RBN Broadcasting Network on September 15th and 16th. That is what was discussed, and Mike repeated the title and my website where the book is advertised many times. I called into Mike's program last week to blame him for it, but he thought I should be grateful. And maybe I should. I can say that Mark Potok is not an expert on the Holocaust Shoah in any way, shape, or form. He is not even conversant with the most fundamental writings, but only the garbage put out in the mass media. He proves that in his introductory statements, which I'm going to quote here. Quote, you probably thought you knew a thing or two about Auschwitz. It was a nightmarish Nazi extermination camp in Poland where more than 1 million people were murdered, most of them gassed to death with Zyklon B and then cremated. Dr. Joseph Mengele performed horrible medical experiments on live humans there, including twins and those with blue eyes. At the end, as the Soviets closed in, the SS guards murdered thousands more as they marched starving survivors west. But Carolyn Yeager wants to set the record straight. Unquote. Well, so far so good. Indeed, I do want to set the record straight. Potok continues from there relating all the amenities at Auschwitz-Birkenau that I cover in my small book, and he does a good job. I'm quite pleased that he is informing his readers of this, even if they are conditioned to find it completely unbelievable. And yes, in the comment section, there are many who express in their automatic, knee-jerk way that I am a nutcase. Someone even said I should be put in a padded cell. I suspect that some of these might be written by Potok or his staff to encourage more mindless comments, but that's only a suspicion. Potok doesn't refute anything I say except to bring up captured Auschwitz commandant Rudolf Hoss's book. And don't confuse Rudolf Hoss, it's hard to pronounce his last name, with Rudolf Hess, who made the trip to Scotland for peace, Hitler's deputy who I talked about a few weeks ago. Rudolf Hoss was the commandant of Auschwitz for much of the time of its existence, not all, and wrote this book after brutal torture to himself and threats about his family that if he didn't do everything they asked of him, they would turn his wife and children over to Soviet agents who would put them in gulags in the Soviet Union, where millions of Germans had already been sent, so it was quite believable. Hoss confessed to murdering 4 million Jews in gas chambers and said that Himmler himself gave him the order. The British had already murdered Himmler by this time, so it was safe to say anything with regards to him. Potok also references Philipp Mueller's testimony, which has been debunked over and over and over again. Other than that, he relies on calling me a woman of leaden stupidity and to describe the Barnes Review, the publisher of the book, as America's leading Holocaust denial journal and a gathering point for anti-Semites and Nazi sympathizers from around the country. The usual stuff from the Guardians of Hate. Well, I hope it will cause more of my books to be sold. I know Mike's program already has done that. To get your copy, go to my website, carolynyager.com, and call the TBR number given there. And I want to remind you that the office that you would be calling is in California. So people in the Eastern and Central time zones, if you call too early, it might be that no one answers. So make your call from 11 a.m. on or so. Now, a VOR listener sent me an email last week containing a Marvel comic book featuring Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, obviously a regular storyline for Marvel. I thought this was a good thing to follow up the SPLC blog post because this is sort of the kind of source that these SPLC-type people and their readers get about the Holocaust. This is where they learn about World War II and the Nazis in things like very similar to comic books. Now, this comic book was number 108 for March 1973, and the storyline was The Hell-Torn Holocaust That Was Dresden. And what a storyline it is, I'll tell you. What it is, they have a small American Special Forces group that are making mincemeat out of the simple-minded Nazis in Dresden right before the big bombing there. But when they learn that the Holocaust of American-British bombs are going to be falling on them too, the story evolves into what they do about that. So the language is comic book style and personal insulting type of stuff that we're all familiar with, very much like the SPLC Hate Watch folks used. And here's some examples that I liked. One of these warriors, these special forces American guys, he's shooting away, you know, with his machine gun, and he's saying, "There's more of them inside, Sarge, but I'm sure we can persuade them to move out." Shoa, spelled S-H-O-A-H in bold letters. Then packa, packa, packa. And here's to you, Heine, and your trip to that great Hofbrau in the sky. Crack. Later, it gets even better. One of the Howling Commandos is a handsome blonde German who has turned traitor and is actually pretending to be a Nazi but is really fighting for the Allies. He's helping a Dresdener escape. This Dresdener man says, "Perhaps if all of us would have been as wise as you, Hitler would never have risen to power." Then he says, "Perhaps I'm still alive to loathe and despise myself for supporting Hitler and to help bring a halt to his mad regime." After that, they go into an air raid shelter and another Dresdener asked the blonde German who was working for the Allies, "Do you plan to kill us here in the bunker? After all, we brought Hitler to power and we could hardly blame you." I thought that was really that was really the pinnacle for me of this book. You won't be surprised to learn that this is entirely the work of Jews. This was actually sent to me by Brian Akira, and he has this on his website, too, I discovered. And he has done some research there, and this is what he found, that the cover artist of this particular comic book is, and probably most of them, is the Jew Elie, this is the way Akira says it, the Jew Elie Katz, otherwise known as Gil Kane. The letterer is the Jew Shmuel Rosen. The creator and editor-in-chief is the Jew Stanley Lieber, otherwise known as Stan Lee. The creator is the Jew Jacob Kurtzberg, otherwise known as Jack Kirby. The publisher is the Jewish firm Marvel Publishing Incorporated, founded by the Jew pornographer Martin Goodman. So you can go to Brian Akira's website and see this comic book posted in full color. Now, on to a newsmaker this past week, David Irving. He is out and about doing more damage to revisionism. I want to say right up front that Irving is not an accredited Holocaust revisionist, as if there is such a thing. But because he is a World War II historian, does not make him knowledgeable in any way about the Holocaust. He is a know-it-all, has come around, it's really a shame, but he has come to be a know-it-all who thinks he doesn't need to study the literature, but just needs to make his own discoveries. As we know, he has flip-flopped around the issue to the point of just about ruining his own reputation as a historian, and that is a real shame. After being incarcerated in Austria, he should have just kept his mouth shut about the Holocaust, but that doesn't seem possible for him to do. Now he is quoted as saying by that really awful Daily Telegraph rag, he says this, quote, "I call my opponents little Nazis who Hitler would be proud of. They want to silence debate and crush dissent." Well, they can't even spell in this newspaper anymore. They mean dissent, I'm sure, but they have it decent. Crush dissent. Okay, he is now saying that Hitler wanted to silence debate and crush dissent. Well, the truth is Hitler's opponents want to silence debate and crush dissent, and they did it in Hitler's time also. It was not Hitler who was crushing dissent to such an extent, except for far left and communists. I mean, I admit that. But Irving, who used to be sort of defending Hitler and blaming everything onto Himmler, is now trying to find a way to rehabilitate himself by distancing himself from Hitler, too, I guess. Poor David Irving. He is experiencing the whole world against him, and if he had acted honorably, he would at least have more friends today. Going on, I'm going to turn my attention now to something that was brought to me from another listener, and that is Andrew in Kansas City. He is interested in the bombing of Wheelan. It's actually pronounced Wheelunge, but I'm just going to pronounce it Wheelan because that's how it looks in English, because it's too difficult for me to try to pronounce the Polish. I think Wheelan is a German name, but it might not be. It might be originally Polish, as far as I don't know. I tried to find out, but I could find out. Now, I have had quite a time researching what happened in Wheelan, and it's because there's not much except from the one side, the Polish point of view. Now, what happened in Wheelan was that the German Luftwaffe, on September 1st, 1939, bombed the town. This was the first day of the German-Polish War. Wheelan is a town near Lodz that was targeted by the Luftwaffe because a Polish cavalry brigade, as well as a Polish infantry division, had been located in the town by German reconnaissance the day before the attack. Some Polish sources dispute that there were any Polish military forces in the town at all, and the town fathers of Wheelan have been trying to get the bombing designated as a war crime, claiming that it's greater than what took place in Guernica, Spain in 1937. You'll recall that I did a program on the truth about Guernica May 31st, and you can find it in my archives and listen to it. Guernica as a war crime terror bombing was a leftist fabrication aided by the mass media, including a famous painter, Pablo Picasso. The town and the Polish government appear to be trying to accomplish the same coup for themselves as the communists did for Guernica. Now, going to the Wikipedia page, bombing of Wieland, I find that it's flagged with one of those little banners that say the neutrality of this page is disputed. And so it should be, because the information that is the basis for this whole page about the bombing of Wieland and what it amounted to comes from a letter written in 2009. By the city representatives to the Nobel Prize Committee in Sweden, nominating Wieland for the Peace Prize. From there, you can find this nominating letter on that webpage. Down, it's used as one of the footnotes, the first footnote. Now, one thing that is interesting to me in trying to figure all this out was that the Wieland City Fathers say that the bombing began at 4:40 a.m., 5 minutes before the shelling of Westerplatte, also in Poland, I believe, which has traditionally been considered the beginning of World War II. Yet the records of the Luftflotte show the bombers left their airfield at 5:02 a.m., and some 20 minutes later they reached the town of Wieland unopposed and dropped thousands of kilograms of bombs. So I conclude from this that the Wieland folk have moved the time of the first attack up 40 minutes so they can claim being the very first attacked of the war, beating out Westerplatte by 5 minutes. And they also say it killed an estimated 1,300 civilians. They don't have a certain number. They weren't counted. Why not? I mean, did they disintegrate like in the Twin Towers and so they didn't exist anymore? They don't have a firm figure. They say an estimated 1,300 civilians, a number more than twice as high as Guernica. See, they're in competition with Guernica. The death toll of Guernica is widely considered, now this is me saying, the death toll of Guernica is widely considered to be 200 at most. So they're exaggerating Guernica along with probably exaggerating their own number. But they say it destroyed 90% of the city center. Now, I don't know how big it size-wise the Wieland was at the time, but it currently has 24,000 inhabitants. I couldn't find a figure for what the population was in 1939. So the city center could not have amounted to very much. And there's a photograph on the wiki page that I mentioned that's called Bombing of Wieland that my listener, Andrew, specially brought to my attention, saying that it looks strangely like a scale model rather than the real thing, and he's right, it does. It doesn't look real, but it no doubt is. But studying it, I tried to figure out why it looked the way it did, and it appears to me that the unreality comes from the very strong lighting that's coming from the left, creating very sharp shadows behind the buildings. What I would attribute to a huge spotlight at night rather than any kind of natural lighting. And I wonder if when the sun rises in the morning, could such sharp shadows be made? Like, it's like on the moon or something. Like night just turns into day without any kind of, you know, without that long space of time that we have where it happens slowly. So I don't understand that photograph. But the picture is described when you enlarge it and go to the page that just has the photograph, and it has a description of it. It says it's just after German Luftwaffe bombing the 1st of September 1939. But the date of the photo is given simply as September 1939. And the source is a Polish postcard from the 1970s. So that may be the reason for its artificial look. I mean, has it been retouched to look more dramatic? Or to look worse than it was, or, you know, I don't know. But there's no author of the photograph either. But it's in the public domain because it was made into a postcard. So, more about Wieland. Wieland is a railroad center, and it's in one of the heavy industrial zones of Poland. Most of what is written about it that I could find is written by Jews who live there, and they call it a shtetl. You know, my shtetl Wieland, and they're remembering back when they lived there. And the city fathers today don't give much of a history. The history they give, they have actually a long, long history going back to like 1100, but it's probably not very believable. But recent history, they don't say much. The only recent history about Wieland is the bombing of it. So strangely, that seems to be what they want to be known for. And well, I'm going to do a little editorializing here. That when I've done a lot of reading, not enough, but quite a bit about Poland and its history, and I believe that Polish history is mostly an invention, just like Jewish history. Not as bad as what the Jews do, because the Polish do have a long history there. But I want to just remark that Gilad Atzmon, who is a Jew, has said that the Bible supplied history for the Jews for a long time, and when the time came that they set out to write their history, they just invented it. And I fit that in with the fact that Elie Wiesel always emphasizes memory as being a valid basis for history. And the reason for that is clear, because they invent their history, so if they remember it that way, that's good enough. They don't have to prove it in any kind of other way that we generally try to show, and certainly not archaeologically. Then Frederick Tobin, the Australian historian revisionist, has said something that I find very profound, and that is, the Holocaust Shoah narrative has no reality in space and time, only in memory. So here you have a tendency, very strong, to create history and try to convince yourself or others that it's true because it's in your memory, or you say you remember it. Or if people say they remember it, then that's good enough to make it real. Anyway, back to the nominating letter to the Nobel Committee, which you can read on the internet. It's written in a very emotional style, full of adjectives. You know, and for example, it claims that the German Luftwaffe turned Wieland into ruins, virtually razed it to the ground. Yet the photo I'm discussing that's on the Wikipedia page shows what's probably the worst part of the city center, and most everything is still standing, with just a portion in the center that looks bombed out, which could be partly an empty field or an empty space, but I can't say that, but there doesn't look like a whole lot of rubble there. So this is a demonstrable exaggeration, but I will say no doubt there was, they have a lot of photographs, and there was a lot of damage done, a lot of damage, but to say that, you know, it was razed to the ground or that the whole city center was bombed out, that's just absolutely not true. And you don't see that from the photographs. Now, who's telling the truth? There's a section further down on the page, on that Wikipedia page, that says other versions of the event. Although this other version does not appear on the wiki page for the city of Wieland, which also makes the same charges without allowing any rebuttal to appear. But in this section, it's stated that German aviation historian Horst Bug concludes that the bomb attacks had been directed against the military formations in the town, can therefore not be considered terror bombings. And due to ground fog, he argues, the German pilots missed their targets and mistakenly bombed the town. This is very similar to what happened in Guernica, although a little bit different. This is also the position of British aviation historian Peter C. Smith and Polish historian Jerzy B. Sink, author of The Polish Air Force at War, The Official History, 1939-1943. Now, there's a little bit more I want to say about this before I'm finished with it, about what the argument between the historians or between the two sides on just who was whether this was a war crime or not. But it's time for the break, so I am going to wait until we get back to conclude this and go on to some other stories. So see you on the other side.
right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
I'm in Berlin with Professor Wilhelm Hankel, who is one of a group of currency experts who filed a suit with the Constitutional Court in Germany against the Greek bailout. Professor Hankel, thanks very much for talking to RT. Now, tell me about the complaint that you've lodged with the court.
The whole idea is illegal because we have the treaty for the European Community. A bailout is completely forbidden for a very simple reason. A country which can count to be bailed out will not follow financial and monetary discipline. So no bailout is a precondition for a stable euro. Having now this bailout, we have to fear the euro will never be in future a stable currency, because all the deficit, Greek is only one case. Next cases are Portugal, Spain, Ireland, maybe Italy and France. So the real fear now is going in Europe. The euro will become a very, very weak currency, inflated. And this is the reason why we started this complaint. The treaty must be fulfilled and not broken.
So you maintain that under the terms of that treaty, a bailout is actually illegal. What outcome do you hope for?
If the court is sharing our view, then the German participation on this whole action will be stopped. And I think we are coming back to the real stability policy, which is now fading away. And maybe Greek is forced to opt out. And why not? Because the country is not very happy with the euro. A weak country with a weak economy cannot share a monetary club having hard rules for stability and hard currency.
And what effect do you foresee for the rest of the Eurozone if countries like Greece and Spain and possibly Italy were forced to pull out?
I think there are two scenarios possible. One is we get a smaller but harder monetary union, not with 16 or maybe 17 members, but only with 10 or 8. But countries which can follow the rules. Or, and this would be another option, the whole experiment of the union, in my view it was not a union but concubinage. 16 countries shared one currency, which is a nonsense in political as well as in economic terms. So if this experiment will be stopped, then the whole group will come back to national currency. So Germany to the Deutschmark, and why not?
The Deutschmark, though, wasn't a particularly strong currency, was it, in the 10 or 20 years leading up to the euro? How do you think the Deutschmark would have performed during the financial crisis?
I think in case all countries are coming back to national currency and Germany to the Deutschmark, then we will have a clear-cut split in euro between countries depreciating and others appreciating. And Germany, I think, given his high surpluses in current account, will belong to the appreciating currencies. And appreciating a currency is not a damage, but it is a real...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and I was talking about the town of Wielen, the bombing that took place there. And I was talking about the military historians and how they backed up the records of the Luftflotte, that there was a brigade and a whole division also of Polish troops in the town that they had found in their reconnaissance the day before September 1st, which I think was August 31st. And so they had every reason to see that as a target. But the Polish town says that there were no forces there whatsoever and that it was a war crime. And the worst thing they did was bomb a hospital when it had a big Red Cross on the top of it or something. But this Horst Boog, who is the, I'm going to say some more about him, he says that due to ground fog, the German pilots missed their targets and mistakenly hit some other things in the town, such as the hospital. And this is also, I said, the position of a British historian and a Polish historian. So, to continue, there is a historian on the Polish side of this argument who sides with the townspeople of Wieland, and he is a British writer who was never, though, an expert on military history, I don't believe. His name was, and he's probably maybe not alive anymore, but Norman Davies, and he was persuaded to write a book backing up the Wielander's position. His book is not listed as a recommended reading on this wiki page, however, but the other three are that I mentioned, and he is also something of a journalist, along with being sort of a historian, and he's married to a Polish woman, so he has his sympathies on that side. And he says, well, this Norman Davies argues that, well, pretty much the same side, that there were no military there and that the Germans should have known what they were bombing because they had a second raid following the first one, and by then things should have cleared up and they should have been able to see and so on. But that's not what's in the aviation report. So now for some further information on this, because I found this awfully interesting, and I hope the rest of you might find it interesting too. So I went to the Axis History Forum because there was a discussion on it, and there's a thread asking, someone asked for information about this particular incident, and a fellow who called himself Molobo argues, well, against the Germans and saying that the Germans committed a war crime, and cites something called the ZDF report in the TV magazine Frontal 21. But these two other fellows disagree with him. And one of them, Jan Hendrik, says, Dr. Horst Boog of MGFA showed here, and he gives a link to a long German archive, that this report was not worth a penny. That is the report that Malobo is putting forth. And the MGFA stands for like a research institute or office or center for military history. And it's highly, I guess it's pretty respectable. And the other guy named Larry replies to Jan Hendrik, and he says, I see what you mean. I have great, great respect for Horst Boog. He is the foremost authority expert on the history of the Luftwaffe during World War II and is widely recognized as such by the academic community the world over. Americans have a special fondness for him because he is a graduate of Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. And he goes on to say he really is critical of the editors at ZDF. That's that report in the TV magazine. The editors at ZDF accusing them of intentionally spreading disinformation in an effort to discredit anything and anyone from the NS period. NS standing for National Socialist. If what he says is true, then the government should open a legal case against ZDF. I guess it makes it pretty serious. And he goes on with more like that. He says, the Germans believed there were Polish troops in Wieland, and they had solid evidence to support that belief. While the Poles claimed there weren't, did the Polish troops depart the town during the heavy morning fog, or were they still there when the German air attack began later in the day? If the Polish, well, that would have been the second attack. If the Polish troops had left and the Germans didn't know about it, are they still guilty of bombing a town that had no military targets, and so on? Malobo replies saying, which do you believe more, the ZDF report or a German military historian? And Jan Hedrick replies, "Dear Malobo, whom do I believe more? A well-known specialist for air warfare in World War II or some internet resources?" Well, that's a rhetorical question, so he doesn't say anymore. And then Larry comes back with, "I'm with you, Jan Hedrick, that Dr. Boog is a thorough, objective, and very distinguished air historian who has been invited to the United States many times to speak before assembled groups of United States Air Force officers and other professionals. He's authored a number of outstanding books and large number of articles in academic journals, both in German and English," and he goes on and on with this kind of praise. So he says, that's good enough for me. And these two fellows are standing with that. And so, in conclusion, I would say that the efforts to make Whelan another Guernica are based on the same political motives as the Guernica efforts were and still are. And I really thank Andrew for asking me to look into this because it's such a good example of the fraud inherent in all the Allies' World War II accounts and the repetition of misinformation found on the Internet. As usual, I found the same information about Whelan on every site I could find about it, except on that forum. One simply copies it from, you know, one site copies it from another, and it's impossible to discover where it originated. Unless you know the origination of a piece of information, you can't judge its credibility. And in this case, we do have Dr. Horst Boog, who is qualified to investigate the bombing and appears to have a reputation as an honest investigator and historian, and find out that it was justified as a normal military operation during the war. And may I say that probably the Nobel Committee will not be finding for Whelan as being worthy of getting a future peace prize. Not that their peace prize has much credibility to it anyway. So that's the story of Whelan, and I hope, Andrew, I've done it justice. I would say that I would urge people to go to the wiki page and look at that picture, and then look at what they say about it, because it just doesn't fit together properly. Now, something else I want to talk about is Zuerst magazine. Zuerst means first, primary, or to begin with. And it's a German news magazine representing the right wing. It's in its first year, and it can be found online just to take a look, kind of see what it's like. They don't let you read all the articles on there, but it can be found at www.zuerst.de. And Zuerst is spelled Zuerst. I highly recommend it for those who read German, which I don't, so I'm not much of a... I want to tell you, though, that I have a copy because one was sent to me by my friend Dr. Wilhelm Klissmann. So I've looked through it, and he sent a few notes along with it. It is, of course, rather expensive. I'm sure it does not have a huge readership, especially since it's new, but also because it's right wing. And it's high quality. It's a very nice magazine, all color, and it's fairly expensive. But if you'd have it mailed here, but if you can afford it and you read German and you're interested in what's going on in Europe and you're right wing, I would say it's something to really consider. Now, as I say, he sent me this issue, and I want to go through it a little bit and tell you about the various articles, because it's like a survey of what the people in the right-wingers in Germany and in Europe are concerned with right now. And on the cover, there's a picture of the new president with the words, "Wolf's Colored Republic." Now, it's in German, but I am translating everything into English. It translates to Wolf's Colored Republic. And, of course, Wolf is the new president, Christian Wolf, who's a member of Merkel's CDU, the Christian Democratic Union, which is always was supposed to have been the slightly right-of-center party in Germany, but to represent whoever might be on the right wing that couldn't be represented by anything any further right than that. But it has become increasingly left, especially concerning immigration. So they go after it quite a bit in this magazine. And inside, the story is titled, "The Man Without a Profile." This is Wolf. And he's described as a multi-culti, multicolor chap, as premier. When he was premier of his Lower Saxonia state, he nominated a Turkish woman as part of his cabinet. See, now, this is so common in the United States, but this is still, Germany is not as far gone as the United States. As bad as we hear about it being, and as much of a clamp as they have there on free speech, still, they're not as bad as we are here. And so to nominate a Turkish woman as part of his cabinet is open to criticism. Well, by the right, it is. It was only at the third vote that Wolf became president, the article reminds everyone, and the first trip he made as president was to Poland. So he's considered a wishy-washy guy. Now, there's a short piece on Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands, reporting that she doesn't let the right-of-center parties form the government, even though, or if, they won the election. Though or if, I'm not sure. But, again, it's like what the people want, what the people say, is ignored and not allowed. Then there's another short piece on Austrian FPO party chief, Heinz Christian Strache, that he appeals to, or that's the Austrian Freedom Party, that he appeals to or is appealing to the Serbian minority in Vienna. And this is seen as a good thing. Now, next is an interview with Gerner Maschke. He is, I don't know who he is, but he has outspoken criticism of the German elite. Now, I think I told you that Dr. Christman sent a few notes so to help me figure out what these articles were about, and that's what I'm expressing to you here. He has outspoken criticism of the German elite, saying they do not want to believe in themselves and don't appreciate their glorious past. And a quote is, "I believe the German people and nation do not like themselves anymore." One of the photographs with this article shows one of the Turkish players on the German soccer team receiving a medal from President Wolf. And another is showing Wolf happily presenting a Suzuki motorcycle to some dignitaries. You know, the BMW are famous for their motorcycles. But they're so proud that they've brought Japanese motorcycles into the country and are promoting them. So the next article has a strange title in English, "To Look at the People's Mouth." Very odd, but that's supposedly what it is. And it's a critique of the former FDP chief and the FDP itself. It's in connection with the Sarrazin book. The gist of it is that the leading politicians and the government are disregarding the wish of their own people. So then the next article of interest, I skip a few of them. There's a lot in this magazine. It's a pretty big magazine. The colored schools. They use the word colored quite a bit. There's no, something doesn't seem to be any, we couldn't use the word colored here in English, but in German it's bunte. The colored schools, terrifying problems at German schools. Too many foreign students lower the education level. And this article has some pictures showing foreign students behaving very aggressively. And also a photograph of two young Negro girls. They are definitely Negro, very dark. One, I mean, not black, but I mean, they're definitely not just, they're not Turks or something. One in traditional Muslim dress, and they're working on their German lesson in a very attractive, clean classroom. But they certainly don't look German. Anyway, then another article is translated as "Revealing Formulation: Pictures of Hillary Clinton with Merkel." And this one is kind of disgusting, and it says, "The U.S. State Department reports about strong misuse of human rights in the Bundesrepublik." Can you imagine? It shows a poster put up by the NRW, whatever that is, new, I don't know what that stands for, but a right-wing group, says it's, the words on the poster say, "Stop Islam, forbid minarets now." And this is misuse of human rights, I guess, according to Secretary of State Clinton from the United States. Then there's a really cool article about former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt. Now, Helmut Schmidt was a Social Democrat, very successful as Chancellor, very popular. He recently made a public statement lauding the success of Hitler in solving unemployment, the Autobahn, the VW, instituting workers' vacations, and so on. But this has not been published. Only in Zuerst is it published. They've published it here. Anyone else gets a jail sentence for saying good things about the Hitler regime. I remember Eva Herman, the blonde journalist, a beautiful blonde TV journalist, who made a simple statement on a panel television talk show that she was on. She's the one who came out with the book and started promoting parenthood for German women, and that German women should start to desire having children and staying home and being mothers instead of focusing on their careers. And she herself took a break from her work and had a baby, and she was thrilled by it, and that's what turned her around. And that got her in enough trouble right there. But then she was on this television program, and she simply said that, well, Adolf Hitler did do something good when he built the Autobahn. And, oh, that raised a furor. The Jews started screaming, and all the social Democrats started yelling, and she had to be fired. I mean, they drove her out. And I think she's home with her children. I think she had another one. But she wrote another book. Anyway, that's what they did to her. But Helmut Schmidt made these statements, and they just don't print them. They don't publish them. Very interesting. Schmidt also, he served in World War II. He was a lieutenant in the Luftwaffe in the flak division. That means he was not flying. I guess he was in the anti-aircraft part of it. Then there's another story, Silent Witnesses. This is about how Poland tries to get rid of the last witness of the German settlements that existed there for centuries by building on former German cemeteries. They're trying to cover up these German cemeteries so that there won't be a reminder that there were German settlements there from, 800 years ago and 900 years ago, that they've been there for all those years. They don't want that in the consciousness. And this is, to me, why I talk about Poles the way I do in Poland, is because I think this is so shameful, the way they behave, while at the same time they demand so much respect for themselves. They overplay their dignity that they deserve, and yet they behave this way. So then Media's Mikado. This is a story about Hans Dichand, who was a publisher of the Austrian newspaper, the Kroner Zeitung, a right-of-center newspaper. Published that for a long time, and he supported Jorge Haider, or Jorg, however you might pronounce it, Haider, the Austrian president, and the FPO, his party. Well, the Haider was the FPO, then he formed a new party, but the FPO is a freedom party. It's an anti-immigrant party. Then there's a story with a picture of Obama as the main photograph there, and it's titled The Molesting Troublemaker. Except that by that they mean the United States, not Obama himself. And that the U.S. is making trouble by planning a revolution in Iran. Then there's something I found very interesting. I wish I could read it. Festival in Padania. I don't know. Padanien is in German. That's in Italy. And this is about the movement to separate North Italy from the southern portion. The group is called Lega Nord. And it seems to me they obviously see themselves as white, or more white and more European than those in the south, and they want to separate from the southern half of Italy. And they seem to have a lot of support. Well, there's a lot of enthusiastic-looking people at their meetings. So I have no position on that whatsoever. Then we have come to something called the ticking time bomb, and this is about the Kurds causing trouble in Turkey once again. And I don't know exactly what the position on that is, but probably it's not too friendly toward the Kurds. I don't know. There are several more stories that I haven't spoken about, and they're more difficult to describe. They're very interesting looking, lots of interesting pictures, and they're more cultural. They're more about cultural topics. So, again, that's Zuerst, and I think it's just wonderful that magazine has even made it, has even come out. And the editor-in-chief, or the publisher, whoever he is, there's a little editorial on the very first page here. He's an older man, These are not young people doing this, but hopefully there are young people involved and young people following it all. And you know, I've heard more and more about the movement in Germany. There's more recognition. There's recognition starting that the right wing is rising, is starting to rise. The New York Times had a story just a few days ago, something about the pressure cooker or something, I think it was. But I read it online, and it said, you know, that the right was pushing, coming forward, and it's kind of accepted that it couldn't be stopped. I mean, I think everybody understands that the right has been suppressed in Germany, even more than in Austria, even more than in other parts of Europe. And you can't outlaw something forever. You can't suppress something forever that's been a part of human belief systems for forever. So it may be kind of like when Adolf Hitler was undoing the Versailles Dictate, that they see it as inevitable, and maybe it really is at hand. I would very much like to read a letter that I got from a reader this past week. It is so nice. I get lots of nice emails from my listeners, and I appreciate every one of them. But I don't read them on the air. But you know, I decided I wanted to read this one because it just touched me so much. And he says, I'm not going to give his name because I don't know if he wants his name mentioned or not. But he said, "Dear Miss Yeager, thank you so much for bringing us the interviews of Dr. Christman. It was truly an honor for me to be able to hear him. I'm an American living in France, but I have such a burden for the German people, knowing how they've been oppressed for the last 65 years. Witness recently the vile Jew hit piece, the Inglorious Bastards," he puts in parentheses. "Having been subjected over the years to countless hours of lying Jewish testimonies, it is refreshing indeed to hear a noble spirit speak of a valiant cause. It seems like I've spent the better part of my life unlearning the propaganda I absorbed in my formative years, in parentheses, state schools all the way through college, BA in history. I'm 48 years old, and it has only been in the last 5 or so years that I've come to understand that the Jews have systematically manipulated information, controlled the media, finance, and our nation for almost 100 years now. Had you told me 10 years ago that I would one day express such sentiments, I would have been revolted. I think it was Zundel's plight that lit the fire. What was the nature of the exterminationist evidence that required the full force of leftist political power to buoy up the exterminist position? How on earth could a so-called free society take virtually everything from a man and lock him up for a mere historical opinion, right or wrong? After reading the transcript from the false news trial edited by Barbara Kulaska, who was one of the lawyers, the scales dropped. No wonder world Jewry had to exert such pressure. The emperor has no clothes." He said, he finishes up with, "I just discovered the Voice of Reason website and your show. Have read one of your articles. Plan to read the others. Please keep up the good work. There is such a tremendous need." He says, "I, for one, want to thank you for our people. I'll keep you in my prayers." Well, isn't it nice to get letters like that? I must say, it makes it all worthwhile. And I want to wish you all a very good night, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at reasonradionetwork.com. We'll be right back.